This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, it's All in the Mind on RN Summer. Lynn Malcolm here with another highlight episode celebrating my past years as host of All in the Mind. In this program from 2018, we take a trip into the world of psychedelia. We're at a psychedelic symposium in Victoria.
Do you take psychedelic drugs?
Yes, I use psychedelic drugs, psilocybin mushrooms, and I have also tried ayahuasca and a couple of other natural. During the experiences, you notice a real openness of the body and mind. Perception of outer reality is heightened and the inner landscape as well. Then I can sort of tell that there have been lasting effects to
my health. I've experimented a lot, but looking back, it was sort of irresponsible experimentation because I recognised that they were having detrimental effects.
I experimented with psychedelics when I was younger, perhaps a bit too much because I didn't know very much about them. So like a few bad trips and then I didn't really touch them for a while. Yeah, off to a bad start, but I feel like we've reconciled.
I can talk about my best experience. That was at Rainbow Serpent in 2012. Just being out all night wandering around, the sun comes up. And just as the sun was coming up, I stopped at one end of the campsite and at that moment realised that I'd stopped grieving for my mum, who'd died when I was a kid, and then had all these affirmations that were set and haven't changed.
I find that the deepest psychedelic experiences are for you alone. But one of the most beautiful moments was simply being spoken to by the mushrooms as I'm picking them under the moon beside a mountain that was shaped like a pyramid. And, you know, I think it becomes wired into your brain to a degree on how deeply you see the natural environment around you and the people around you as well.
What I find is when you're in the psychedelically awakened state, it feels like you are untangling neurological pathways that perhaps you've fed too much negativity in the past. You break down old patterns, and this psychedelic sort of jumpstart or reboot to the brain gives you so many other ways of looking at reality and so much more empathy for the world around you.
The Entheogenesis Australis Psychedelic Symposium is a gathering of researchers and others interested in the therapeutic benefits of psychedelics. What defines the psychedelic experience is the hallucinogenic effect. It causes a shift in one's perception of reality. David Nichols describes his experience taking the psychedelic drug DMT.
It came on incredibly fast. The room I was in twisted up and to the right. I found myself in some sort of wormhole-like tunnel, and it was as if all of a sudden my consciousness, as far as I was concerned, I had died, and yet I was completely okay with it. It felt like the most natural thing in the world to suddenly be. I found myself moving through this tunnel. All I could think was, huh, this feels so right.
And all of a sudden, I came into this space,
and in the space was this bejeweled, fractal, Taj Mahal-like structure that I couldn't help but marvel at the beauty. There was something about it that I just recognized, that it was some intrinsic component of who I was, who I am. And there was this permeating sense of that this place had its own coherent independence, and that it didn't matter that I had just ingested this psychoactive compound. It wasn't. When I came down, I was just floored by the fact that reality can do that. As a human being, I can, you know, smoke or vaporize this compound. It seemed to raise so many questions about the nature of consciousness, the nature of reality. What is this existence in which we find ourselves in? And the ontological questions that come spilling forth after that are just fascinating.
In the next couple of All in the Mind episodes, we'll explore the emerging science of psychedelic drugs. We've just heard people speaking about their recreational use of psychedelics. It's important to note that psychedelic drug use is mostly illegal, and it does come with risks to physical and mental health. So we're not endorsing their use, but we'll discuss the emerging scientific research into the therapeutic potential of psychedelics for treating mental illness.
Just then when the hurdy-gurdy man came singing singing songs of love. Then when the hurdy-gurdy man came singing songs of love.
Most of us associate psychedelic drugs with the countercultural 1960s. Psychologist Timothy Leary introduced them into therapy and urged young Americans to use them. Turn on, tune in, and drop out was his catch cry. Psychedelics were made illegal in the US by 1966, but they're making a comeback in the therapeutic space. Dr. Ben Sessa is a consultant psychiatrist and senior research fellow in psychedelic science at Imperial College London. He says we're in the midst of a psychedelic renaissance.
In terms of psychedelic drug use, they became banned and they became blamed. And then we then had this 30 or 40 year hiatus where these drugs were very demonized. What's happened in the last 10 or 15 years is we've started to see an interest in them again, not just within medicine, but within culture and the arts as well. And in a way, it had to happen this way. We had to have the likes of Timothy Leary, and we had to have the drug banning in a way, because now we're coming to it with a new generation. We are a lot more pharmacologically savvy today than we were back then. The general public no longer buy the government line that crack cocaine is the same as cannabis. When I was a youngster in the 70s, the drug education message was, if you smoke cannabis, it's the same as injecting heroin. You know, we're much more savvy than that now. We know what the killers are. We can see where methamphetamine and alcohol particularly are destructive to our society. Crack cocaine, heroin. So we're no longer buying this government line of all drugs should be put in the same basket. So I think this is a big part of the psychedelic renaissance. It's about an increased savviness of psychopharmacology and the true causes of drug misuse versus drug use. So that's one reason. Another reason is medicine grasping these drugs. And goodness me, where could we have been now in our understanding of neuroscience and psychiatry had we not banned these drugs at the end of the 60s? We've had this huge hiatus, and now we're revisiting those studies of the 60s using modern neuroimaging techniques. And it's opening up whole new doors in terms of our understanding of consciousness. Now, another reason why perhaps the psychedelic renaissance is happening is I think there's a general sense of malaise with traditional psychiatry. I think there's a lot of patients who've been parked on these long-term, lifelong maintenance drugs like SSRIs, and they're turning to their doctors and they're saying, this ain't working for me. You've got to have something better. What else have you got in the cabinet? So psychiatry itself is undergoing a renaissance. The psychedelics represent the newest, most innovative form of psychopharmacology for around 75 years. You know, it's totally new. Unlike all of these other maintenance drugs, they're the first time that we're using these drugs in a sophisticated way to enhance psychotherapy, to get to the root cause of trauma. And I think this is a much more sophisticated and clever pharmacology way of tackling these problems. So it's a combination of all these things that really means that the ground is very fertile for this psychedelic renaissance.
One of Ben Sessa's early experiences of recreational psychedelic drug use was with MDMA, or what's commonly known as ecstasy.
And this was when I was age 18 or something, taking ecstasy around that age with my friends. And I remember we were lying there in someone's house after going out, and everyone was high, and we were, you know, in that sort of youthful, explorative, experimental type way of thinking. We were all kind of intellectual, and we read Jung and all this sort of stuff. And I remember we were lying there and we were saying, oh, wow, this is so amazing. Look, try and think of the scariest thing you can. Try and think of the worst thing in the world. And we went, yeah, okay, let's try that. Let's imagine our mum's dying. Oh, wow, it's not that bad. I could deal with that. And what's really interesting, I didn't know at the time, it was only in more recent years that I've come to find MDMA therapy. What I was doing there with my friends was essentially carrying out a little brief experiment of what we do with MDMA therapy. The drug provides this ability to engage with painful thoughts that normally you would avoid, but under the drug, you can go there and do it, and it's not that bad. Now, it's not an experience that at the time had any profound effect on me, but now on reflection, it's really profound because it's given me a taste of that's what we do when we use MDMA in psychotherapy for trauma.
MDMA, or ecstasy, is not a classical psychedelic like LSD, psilocybin, or DMT, but it's been popular in the nightclub scene. Whilst it can produce feelings of increased energy, pleasure, emotional warmth, and distorted perception, it can also cause unpleasant and sometimes dangerous effects. However, MDMA is being researched in controlled clinical settings as an adjunct to treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. As a child and adolescent psychiatrist, Ben Sesser is interested in the developmental trajectory from child maltreatment to adult mental health disorders, such as trauma and addiction. This is where he believes psychedelic medicine, like MDMA, can play a role in effective treatment.
One of the problems of things like PTSD or addictions or other chronic mental disorders or personality disorders, it's the rigidity of this. When you've learned these adaptive mechanisms from the age of one onwards, the narratives that develop are very rigid and it's hard to shift them. And the psychiatric profession is in a very poor state when it comes to psychopharmacology. We have a whole wealth of different maintenance drugs which treat symptoms. They paper over the cracks. If they're depressed, give them an antidepressant. If they can't sleep, give them a hypnotic. If their mood goes up and down, give them a mood stabilizer. If they become paranoid, give them an antipsychotic. None of these drugs cure the patient. These drugs are treating the overlying symptoms. The underlying cause is trauma and pain and childhood maltreatment and abuse. So what psychedelics offer is the opportunity to do focused and clear and effective psychotherapy that gets to the root of the cause, gets to the trauma, and for the first time in their lives begin to resolve these issues that they've been a slave to for decades. If you were to invent a drug to treat trauma, it would be MDMA. It seems to tick all of those boxes. And this is really as a result of its very unique receptor profile. It's acting at a 5-HT1A and 1B receptors, which produces a sense of positive mood and reduction in depression and anxiety, acts at the 5-HT2A receptors, which increases creative thinking and allows you to see things in a new way. It's acting at the dopamine receptors with a mild stimulatory effect, whilst paradoxically also acting in the alpha 1 and 2 receptors to slightly reduce the level of arousal. And it has this incredible effect within secreting oxytocin, which is a hormone produced by the brains of breastfeeding mothers to engender a sense of positivity and attachment and bonding. So in totality, these effects add up to this picture of a patient being able to recall and access repressed emotional memories that normally are painful, but in the MDMA state, they're not overwhelmed by the negative affect that comes from recall of those memories. So if you take a patient with PTSD or addictions, they've spent the last 20 or 30 years doing anything about think about that night when they were 8 years old and their grandfather came into their bedroom. They'll do anything. They'll take heroin, they'll drink, they'll self-harm, they'll attempt suicide, and they'll be maintained on all these medications that just keep the symptoms slightly suppressed. But they will not go there to do that work around trauma-focused therapy, because as soon as they recall those memories, they go into this dissociative state in which they have this multimodal sensory recall of that experience. Now, what MDMA does is it very selectively takes out the fear response of the recall of those memories, leaving the other faculties intact. So you're in a state of open-minded, clear consciousness to carry out the psychotherapeutic reaction with your therapist whilst suppressing the fear response. And what you get is patients saying, yes, I can talk to you about my rape. I've spent 30 years doing anything but even, I can't even mutter the word rape. And suddenly on this drug, I'm going to tell you all about it. It allows this window of opportunity to do the trauma-focused psychotherapy, which is then lasting. And what the results have shown with MDMA psychotherapy for trauma is after a course of MDMA, which would be, say, 10, 12, 14 weeks, in which they take MDMA therapy maybe just two or three times, they no longer fulfill the diagnostic criteria for PTSD. And when followed up at 3.5 years later, they still no longer fulfill the diagnostic criteria. And many of them have come off the maintenance drugs in that time. So in a way, it's not that magical. It simply puts you into that proportion of people who can do trauma-focused psychotherapy. So it moves you from the treatment-resistant half into the treatment-reactive half.
Dr. Ben Sesser, psychiatrist, researcher and author. You're with All in the Mind on RN. I'm Lynne Malcolm. Today, the emerging research into the therapeutic potential of psychedelic drugs for mental health. Rick Doblin is founder and executive director of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS. It's a not-for-profit pharmaceutical company focused on developing marijuana and psychedelics into approved legal prescription medicine. their highest priority project is funding clinical trials of MDMA as a tool to assist psychotherapy for the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder. They've been doing what are called Phase 2 pilot studies for the past 16 years. The participants are given MDMA and go through an 8-hour psychotherapy session.
So it's a 2-person therapy team. And the essence of the method was basically developed by Stan Grof and others from their approach with high-dose LSD, although it's fundamentally different with MDMA. And it's based on a belief that there's an upwelling from the psyche that has healing potential, and that we see that in dreams, that we all have this emergence into consciousness of sort of repressed fears or anxieties or even just positive memories, that there was an inner healing mechanism. That is a belief, but it's been based on empirical evidence from a lot of the psychedelic psychotherapy research for the last 40, 50 years. The classic Freudian concept is that the therapists let you free associate and then they help interpret for you what's going on. And so our sense is that the expert is you, the person is their own therapist, that our job is to support what's emerging. And because it's an 8-hour session, we have the time and the patience for people to find their own ways. Because what we find is at some point, people need to address the trauma and address it by describing it, by recalling it, but then trying to transform the fearful emotions into ones of acceptance. And then what MDMA does is it reduces the fear response to a perceived emotional threat. And so people are able to fundamentally take this trauma that has so impinged on their consciousness that it feels that it colors everything and comes in their nightmares and feels like it's always about to happen again. Everything they're seeing through this lens of the past. And under MDMA, people are able to process the fears. Their memory is enhanced for the trauma. And I think that's a really important part of it, is that we find that people have a greater recall to the fine details of what actually happened to them. That before, the emotions were so negative and fearful that they blocked out the memory itself. So the memory comes even more than ever before. And then by processing the fears, and by noticing and being able to be so grounded in themselves in the moment that they could see that this is a supportive therapeutic environment and that that is not being replayed, the trauma is not actually happening right now. There's been a lot of neuroscience studies that have looked at how memories are processed, and it's called memory reconsolidation, where whenever you remember something, you actually bring it from different parts of your brain and then you kind of recreate the memory. It's not like pulling a book off the shelf and then sticking it back. You kind of pull the book off the shelf and then you rewrite the book and it gets stored again. And so the episodic memory, the memory for what happened, is enhanced, and the emotional content of that memory is processed and replaced with a sense that it's in the past, with kind of a peaceful, I've learned certain lessons from it. So that memory reconsolidation then changes the memory tone. And the next time somebody remembers it, they remember the incident, but they can bring back a sense that they're looking at it from a peaceful place and it's in the past. We're not saying necessarily that our method is the best method. So we are actually funding studies with some of the leading experts who've developed cognitive processing therapy, prolonged exposure, and cognitive behavioral therapy, and helping them blend MDMA with their existing methods. So we're trying to support the field of PTSD researchers in exploring the potential of MDMA in many different methods.
Rick Doblin and his colleagues are very optimistic about the outcome of their latest research.
Well, the results are outstanding in both safety and efficacy, and because of that, the FDA has declared MDMA-assisted psychotherapy a breakthrough therapy. They've designated MDMA as a breakthrough therapy. So in terms of safety, first off, our results are very reassuring because we're only giving MDMA several times. It's given in an indoor setting. It's not a rave. People are not dancing. They're not overheating. They're getting adequate fluid. They're getting fluid with electrolytes. We do screen people out with hypertension, but now we're letting people in with controlled hypertension. We've found no problems with temperature in the rave setting. People sometimes dance all night and overheat and don't get adequate fluids, and people have died from hyperthermia. Sometimes to correct that, people have drank a lot of water and died from hyponatremia, from too much water. So we feel that in the therapeutic setting, not just in our studies, there's been over 1,400 people have received MDMA in clinical research settings of different kinds from researchers all over the world. There's never been a case of anybody overheating. There's never been a case of hyponatremia. There's never been a heart attack. There's never been anything like that. We've done neurocognitive testing before and after, because the concern about, if you look at the literature, the scientific literature on heavy ecstasy use, and they're trying to find what are the negative consequences of that, they focus on neurocognitive performance, memory, attention, things like that. So we've done neurocognitive tests before and after and find no evidence of harm. So we think that, first off, we've demonstrated safety in our results, and that the minimal exposure makes that even more persuasive.
The researchers at MAPS estimate from their research so far that two-thirds of the people who have treatment-resistant PTSD can be helped with this kind of psychotherapy. MAPS are now in phase 3 of their pilot study. They also aim to make MDMA into a Food and Drug Authority approved prescription medicine by 2021. For a response to the potential future use of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy in Australia, head to the All in the Mind website for an interview with the head of substance use research at Origin. And we've added extra material on Australian psychedelic research to the podcast stream of this program. Rick Doblin says that one of the effects of psychedelics is that they create a shift in mindset, and it seems to last.
One of the things that really surprised me when I did a 25-year follow-up study to the Good Friday experiment was the persistence of memory. That those people that, this was a Good Friday experiment looking at whether psilocybin produced mystical experiences, and this was Timothy Leary and Walter Pankey did it in 1962. So it was an early psychedelic era research, and it was in the middle 80s that I did the 25-year follow-up. And everybody who had the psilocybin remembered crystal clear some portions of it. They didn't remember the whole experience, but there is something about the psychedelic experience and the emotional connection to it, and often the way it's wrapped up in metaphor and story, that anchors in people's memories. And so it does persist. And we've seen in our research with MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD, sometimes people have had just one experience and 8 years later, they're still over their PTSD. So there's something that we're learning more from some of the neuroscience about how neuroplasticity, that, you know, we know that when people are young, they can learn languages a lot easier, that when you get older, it gets harder and harder. And so there seems to be something about the MDMA, and also, I believe, about the other psychedelics that enhances this neuroplasticity. It's almost like stem cells, in a sense, that can go in many different ways, that you get to this place where you can reorder how your brain is structured, and you can build new neural pathways from one psychedelic experience.
Dr. Ben Sessa is passionate about furthering psychedelic research for mental well-being. One of the big barriers, he says, to wider acceptance of this research is the issue of stigma and safety.
The psychedelic drugs, particularly classical psychedelics, are extremely safe. And MDMA is extremely safe. I'm saying that from a data-driven perspective. Physiologically, they're virtually inert, the classical psychedelics. LSD is so potent as a drug, it's really not a toxic drug at all from a physiological perspective. the rates of morbidity and mortality with these drugs is staggeringly low. Now, the argument would be, well, what about the psychological risks and harms? Well, these are actually also extremely minimal, especially if you take the drug in the right way. These drugs, more so than many other drugs, are very dependent upon the set, which is the mindset at which you go into the experience, and the setting, which is the kind of environment and the conditions. And when these things are, you pay attention to these things, then the risks are reduced to an absolute minimum. The opportunity to explore different mental states and different states of consciousness is very valuable, and it's actually a very fundamental part of human existence. It's only relatively recently, in the last 100 years or so, that we've found something dirty or forbidden about altered states. You know, altered states are a very important part of humanity's development, and you see this in non-Western cultures today. They are at the birth of all religions. So these experiences can be wholly positive for personal growth and development and for community cohesion and bringing people together. But there's an immense amount of fear around this. I have no doubt that the listeners, even hearing me say these things, would be shocked. I ask you to reflect on that. Why are you shocked? It's the fear that's been induced by the drug prohibition. And the danger is this pushes people towards a more dangerous use of the drug. If we want to control drugs, we need to regulate their use, not attempt to mindlessly ban them and eradicate them. Humans have been using them for tens of thousands of years. We're not going to ban the human desire to alter consciousness, but we can get it under better control. This means setting up a system in which people can use these drugs in safe settings for personal growth and development.
Ben Sessa, psychiatrist, researcher and author. Why does Rick Doblin from MAPS think it's so important to do further research on the use of psychedelic drugs for mental well-being?
Well, I think the world is in danger. My sense of the long-term survival of the human species of the planet is that we need people to be able to more clearly identify as being part of nature rather than separate from nature, and more clearly identify as being part of the human species. And then we need to go beyond the ways in which we classify ourselves, tribalism, nationalism, religion. We need to see our interconnectedness. And that once you see your interconnectedness, you're not so easily willing to demonize others that are different from you. And I think that that's the kind of long-term strategy that I've been working on. And I feel that there's all different ways that people can have those kind of experiences. Psychedelics are not producing unique psychedelic experiences. They're producing human experiences mediated by psychedelics. That can come through many different ways, but I think psychedelics throughout history for thousands of years have been a reliable catalyst for that experience. So I think we need mainstream psychedelics, mainstream mysticism, mainstream a deeper kind of understanding in thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions and billions of people eventually. And so I think the reason for doing the medicine and the research is to try to open the culture up so that eventually there can be these opportunities for more and more people. So I think we need broad-based mental health improvements, and I think psychedelics can contribute to that.
Rick Doblin, Director of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS. If anything in this program has raised concerns for you, call Lifeline on 131114 or the SANE helpline on 1800 187 263. Thanks to producer Diane Dean and sound engineer Mark Don. I'm Lynn Malcolm. It's great to have your company. Bye for now. Here comes a roly-poly man and he's singing songs of love. Roly-poly, 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 poly is singing. Hurdy-gurdy, 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 gurdy is singing. Hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.